it's sort of a contradiction to describe somebody as being simultaneously widely remembered and yet almost at the same time completely forgotten. But it might be true for a guy named John Gray because, for example, any of you who are regularly in Dublin or who are Dubliners themselves, there's a statue of him on O'Connell Street, but you might even struggle to picture it, let alone to pick it out or place where on the street it actually is. But in these days where we're constantly being reminded to wash our hands and we're all very mindful of the benefits of good sanitation, we should remember John Gray because he's a man to whom we owe an awful lot. He had a remarkable impact on public health. He is, believe it or not, the man responsible for clean running water in Ireland's capital, and he did also inspire other Irish cities to invest in proper water supplies as well. He's also a man of some contradictions. He was a knight of the realm. In fact, if you go to the statue, you'll see it's a statue for Sir John Gray. And yet he was an Irish nationalist who believed in repealing the Act of Union, which makes him a fascinating topic for another installment of Hidden Histories with Donal Fallon. Donal, afternoon. How are you?
Good to be here. Good to be here.
He's a fascinating choice, and we'll get to him in just a second. But for many people, I suppose it's worth remembering that, you know, we take it for granted in the first world, but for a lot of people, clean water is still a distant dream, isn't it?
Yeah, there's an interesting fact that you can read one of two ways. The World Health Organization, isn't it brilliant to have an Irishman leading from the front in this with the World Health Organization? But the World Health Organization says that 71% of the world's population today has access to what they call safely managed clean drinking water, which is brilliant. But you could read that fact another way entirely, which is that a remarkable 29% of the world's population don't. So we know at present that, you know, a humble bar of soap and water is our greatest ally in this current fight. And yet it's something that it's very easy to take for granted, clean water. But you can't talk about the story of water and water supply in Ireland without John Gray. He is the centre of that great tale.
Yeah, 29%, by the way, of the world's population, back of an envelope stat thing, so that's about 2 billion people. So it's a huge amount of people who don't have the same privileges the rest of us have. It was the second half of the 19th century or so, though, before we managed to join the leagues of the countries that got it right.
Which is remarkably late. I mean, we're talking the 1860s, so, you know, post-Irish famine, and the honour falls to the brilliant John Gray. And his monument is funny, you know, it says, in honour of our appreciation of his many services to his country and of the splendid supply of pure water which he secured for Dublin. But when you think of that street, it's just dominated by, you know, the towering monuments, Daniel O'Connell on one end, Charles Stewart Parnell on the other, and the Spire of Light in the middle. So poor old John Gray there opposite Supermax is someone that we walk by all the time, but we never see. But perhaps more than, and this is a big thing to say, perhaps more than anyone else on that street, you know, we owe so much to John Gray.
I was literally going to ask you where in the street it is, because I mean, I've lost count of the number of times that I've walked down that street and I honestly could never place it. And if you asked me to name all the different monuments or installations in the middle of the street, I'd have said O'Connell, the Spire, Parnell at the other end, Jim Larkin. There's also that statue of the Virgin Mary up towards the Gresham end. Honest to God, I would never have been able to pick out where John Gray was. Don't think I've ever even noticed him, which is perhaps a sign of just how much he's overlooked. Tell me about his history. He came from a fairly gilded background.
From Claremorris, County Mayo, born 1815. And I mean, we're talking the upper echelons of Irish society. I mean, he attends Trinity College Dublin, enters the medical profession, and unusually for someone from his kind of class background and his religious background, becomes a really enthusiastic supporter of the message of Daniel O'Connell. So you have O'Connell, you know, a Catholic, the living, breathing kind of representation of the Catholic demand for equality, and this young, unlikely kind of Protestant ally, Trinity College graduate, young Gray. Mm. But before getting into the water supply question, John Gray is primarily known in 19th century Ireland as a newspaper proprietor. He runs the hugely popular Freeman's Journal paper. And back then, I mean, the Irish Times was the traditionally unionist paper, you know, kind of liberal Protestants who believed in the connection between these islands.
Yeah.
And then you had Gray's paper, the Freeman's Journal, which struck a very different note. I mean, it was a very nationalistic paper. And today it's kind of forgotten, the Freeman's, but I mean, it was a big deal. And Ulysses Leopold Bloom works in the office of the Freeman's Journal. So for Irish nationalists, you know, for supporters of say, Parnell, later Redmond, it is the paper of choice. And he uses the Freeman's Journal like a blunt object, you know, to just hit the authorities over the metaphorical head with. And as a trained medical professional, one of his obsessions that comes through in the paper all the time is water, water, water.
So tell me then about the water supply at the time of the Freeman's Journal. How is it in Dublin?
It was famously bad. I mean, it was atrociously bad. And the joke internationally was that Guinness owed its colour to the imagined use of Dublin Liffey water. You know, for almost a century, Dublin was drawing water from the canals. And there was a couple of problems. There wasn't enough water, for one thing, but it had too low a head and pressure. So you couldn't bring it to the upper floors of houses And more importantly, the Dublin Fire Brigade couldn't use it to put out fires. It was pretty useless. But the canal's a dumping ground, and there's inquiries into the canal, and it's too early in the morning, to be honest, to read some of the contemporary accounts of the water for anyone who's having a late brunch. But I mean, bad and infamous would be two of the nicer ways that, that canal water is described in 19th century Dublin. And one report says 10,000 houses out of 24,000 houses between the canals had no running water at all, which is extraordinary.
Wow. You mentioned that how Guinness reputedly drew its colour from it, of course famously red rather than black, but some people even insisted that the quality of the water actually encouraged some people to drink.
Well, you couldn't drink the stuff, you know, and this has been a long-standing issue. I mean, back in the days of Jonathan Swift, he made many jokes about the Liffey water, but there were 55 breweries in 18th century Dublin, and lots of them into the 19th, because as the temperance movement put it, you wouldn't drink the stuff. So they argued that it was contributing to the levels of drunkenness and bad behaviour in the city. If the water was so famously bad, beer was always preferable, even if it would land you in trouble on occasion in its own way.
Even though the beer was probably in some way derived from the same bad water that everyone was talking about. But any excuse. Part of the problem, though, and you've made this point in the notes that you've sent in for this, part of the reason why Dublin was so overlooked when it came to good sanitation and running water like that was that it was then a very much working class area, that the middle class had gotten out of the canals.
By the second half of the 19th century, what you see happening is people are moving beyond the canals, and they set up what they call their own townships. So Mines is probably the most famous example of it. And basically, they kind of just waved back at people who lived between the canals and said, you know, best of luck with that. We're doing our own thing now. So the middle class are gone, and they establish their own kind of urban district councils, as they call them. So they have their own local councillors. They have their own fire service. Basically, every aspect of their lives they run for themselves. So the less middle class people you have, the less income the city has. Dublin is broke. And you have Gray, a town councillor, adamant that if you can fix this thing, if you can fix the water question, the effect will be immediate across the board in terms of the economy, in terms of health, in terms of everything else. So he argues, you know, we have to entice people back into the city. And one way we can do that is by going to war on the issue of water.
I like how the middle class leaving the canals, they basically just invented suburbs and just decided that Rathmines was just going to be a suburb.
I would say that they're the earliest suburbs, you know, the likes of Pembroke, Rathmines. That's exactly what it is. It's the idea of getting out of the city. And eventually it became fashionable to go back into the city. But back then, getting out was the priority.
Mm. So John Gray at this point then is a town councillor. He's adamant that, you know, if you fix the water issue, that everything else then begins to fall into place. This being the 1860s, they somehow get the job done.
And when we sometimes in Ireland, when we get it right, we really, really get it right. You know, Ard na Cruaile in the 1920s was an absolutely incredible achievement. But I would say the Dublin water question is another example of something we really, really nailed. And it was primarily thanks to Gray's kind of pressure and commitment that Dublin invests in just remarkable sums of money, like 20 years after the famine, you know, unbelievable sums of money in addressing this issue of issues. And the answer, as they cracked it, lay outside Dublin at Wicklow and the Vartry Reservoir scheme. And if it's within your 2 kilometres, listeners, you can go and have a walk around it and have a look at it. And it's absolutely incredible. And it looks like a little Dublin colony when you walk around the reservoir, because you've got the three castles. You've got the Dublin City Council logo. There's a bust of John Gray. And even those kind of, you know, those weird seahorses that are on the Grattan Bridge in town, they're on it as well. So it's like this little part of Dublin in Wicklow. But I mean, it was a genius scheme. And the heroes of the story, not only Gray, but the city surveyor, Park Neville, he nailed it. I mean, a capacity for 11.3 billion litres of water. Which was just extraordinary.
Wow.
A filtration system, the construction of piping and more to kind of carry fresh water into the heart of the capital. So the answer to Dublin's water problem lay beyond Dublin, and Gray nailed it.
I like that. That's the start of Dublin's sort of cultural appropriation of everything else. Now we have basically a capital city and a forgotten country that sort of lives around to service it. But even back then, they just decided to seize the assets of Wicklow. That's what was meant. And then, of course, this led to the rather bizarre situation that those who then, as you mentioned, who had left life inside the canals, suddenly then found themselves the lesser off, because the new system that Gray had pioneered left them out.
The good people of Rathmines Urban District Council suddenly changed their tune, and they were kind of back with cap in hand, which is kind of funny. You know, people who had left Dublin because Dublin was broke were now back with cap in hand saying, can we have a little bit of this? This is pretty impressive. So public health is more important than politics. And in fairness to Dublin Corporation, ultimately, that Vartry scheme ended up bringing clean water beyond the canals as well. So the likes of Rathmines Urban District Council, they got in on the action. And at the opening of the scheme, Gray is bestowed with a knighthood. So you have this strange moment where, you know, a man who's given much of his life beyond water to things like supporting Daniel O'Connell and the cause of Irish self-rule becomes Sir John Gray. But he remains kind of committed to political reform, an elected MP right up to his death, 1875, 59 years of age, very young man at the time of his passing.
And of course, then it goes without saying that we still enjoyed the benefits, but that the health benefits even at the time were fairly immediate and pretty acute.
Absolutely. Typhus and cholera, I mean, two absolutely lethal killers. And the health reformers of the day back then were people like William Wilde, Oscar Wilde's dad, John Gray. They all made the point that there was a link between, you know, infectious disease and poor water supply. Believe it or not, there was a lot of academic debate back then around infectious disease, even if disease was infectious. But they made the argument very, very strongly and very, very, very plain. Mm. And the ability to wash our hands now is something that we just take it for granted in this part of the world. But, you know, could we do it without John Gray? And when I was researching this, I found a lovely piece by Mary Mulville, sadly missed in recent years, a woman who did a lot to popularise kind of science and talk about science in Ireland. And she wrote a beautiful column, an Irish woman's diary, as they call it on occasion in the Irish Times. And she opened it so beautifully, but they're perfect words to close with this morning. She said, "Ladies and gentlemen, please take your glasses, fill them with clean water from your kitchen taps, and join me in drinking a toast to the memory of Sir John Gray, doctor, journalist, parliamentarian, nationalist, and campaigner." So every time you turn on the taps, remember John Gray.
I certainly think of him next time that I'm passing Supermax on O'Connell Street. turn out and look and raise a glass of tap water and toast him. Donald, fascinating stuff. Thank you as ever for bringing us that story. Sir John Gray, really, really fascinating stuff. Donald Fallon is a historian. He's the author of the Come Here to Me books, and he's the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast, which you can find anywhere you get good audio online.